We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft cock.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Holy shit, people. Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke from San Diego. I'm Greg Carlwood. I finally got my computer working again. Sorry about not having a show last week, but you know how it goes. Everything is still going well. I'm psyched about today's show. We have James Corbett of The Corbett Report, and I'm sure a lot of listeners and conspiracy nuts will know of James because he's got one of the most popular podcasts for the current events in global politics that they don't want you to know about. First, we're going to run through a spot for the THC Money Bomb so I don't have to repeat myself every week. And then my special lady is going to deliver this week's higher education so you don't have to listen to me. And then, ladies and gentlemen, we'll get to the only real reason why you're here, and that's the interview portion of the show this week with James Corbett of The Corbett Report. People, I got to tell you about a little something we're calling the THC Money Bomb. The way it works is I'm going to pool up all the donations I get before episode 85, and I'm going to give half back to one of you listeners. So if you can, consider donating 5 or 10 bucks to THC. You'll be supporting a show you love and know that half your donation is going to go to some random, fairly like-minded individual. Hell, it might even be you. The more people we get involved, the bigger impact we can collectively have. I'm really sort of tired of just talking about community and helping people, and I would rather just do it. So if you're with me, go to thehiresidechats.com/donate. And to keep things kosher, I must also add that you can get into the pool without a donation. If $5 is too much, just send me a letter with your info to Greg Carlwood, P.O. Box 635223, San Diego, California, 92163. So there it is. And if you've donated already, thanks so much. Keep an eye on your PayPal account. I might just blow it up. That's the THC Money Bomb. Boom.
Hey everybody, I'm Tiny Dancer, and in a world full of secret agendas and corporate censorship, it's hard to know what's what. That's where your higher education comes in. A recently published Harvard University meta-analysis funded by the National Institutes of Health has concluded that children who live in areas with highly fluoridated water have significantly lower IQ scores than those who live in low fluoride areas. And a 32-page report that can be downloaded free of charge from Environmental Health Perspectives, the researcher said, quote, "We've concluded that adverse effects of high fluoride concentrations in drinking water may be of concern and that additional research is warranted. Fluoride may cause neurotoxicity in laboratory animals, including effects on learning and memory." Huh, you think? There are so many scientific studies showing the direct toxic effects of fluoride on your body, it's truly remarkable that it's not considered a scientific consensus by now. And next over at Godlike Productions, conspiracy forums have posed an interesting theory on Paul Walker's untimely death from the car crash on Saturday. They tie it in and call it a murder to prevent Walker, who is part of the Philippine relief effort, from exposing, quote, "a conspiracy to supply victims of the typhoon with a prototype of permanent birth control hidden in the medical and food aid supplies." Another theory is that Walker discovered dirty money in the Philippines disaster relief and that it would make sense because he owned a company that specialized in rapid disaster relief. Who knows? And on the GMO front, the GM Super Salmon muscling its way onto your plate. As they splash around on their tanks, they look like any other healthy Atlantic salmon. Their eyes are bright, their skin is gloriously silvery, and their fully grown bodies exude power. It's only when you look closely at their hatching dates that alarm bells start to ring. A normal Atlantic salmon takes 30 months to grow to maturity. This variety took just 16. The majestic specimen are frankenfish, genetically modified salmon created in a secretive research base in the Panama rainforest. Frankenfish are genetically modified salmon created by the company Aqua Bounty, which grow at twice the rate of wild Atlantic salmon and are constantly hungry. The salmon have been given genes from two other species of fish to make them grow twice as fast as normal. And while most people would balk at the prospect, GM fish could soon be coming to a dinner table near you. Last week, Canadian authorities gave approval for the commercial production of GM salmon eggs for the first time, while U.S. food regulators are in the final stages of approving the fish for sale in supermarkets and restaurants. And where GM salmon lead, other animals will follow. Plans are in place to genetically modify up to 50 other species, including trout and tropical whitefish tilapia, for human consumption. GM chickens, cattle, sheep, and pigs will not be far behind. And in our last story today, Mark Chivarella Jr., a 61-year-old former judge in Pennsylvania, has been sentenced to nearly 30 years in prison for literally selling young juveniles for cash. He was convicted of accepting money in exchange for incarcerating thousands of adults and children into a prison facility owned by a developer who was paying him under the table. The kickbacks amounted to more than $1 million. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has overturned some 4,000 convictions issued by him between 2003 and 2008, claiming that he violated the constitutional rights of juveniles, including the right to legal counsel and the right to intelligently enter a plea. Some of the juveniles he sentenced were as young as 10 years old. Chivarella was convicted of 12 counts, including racketeering, money laundering, mail fraud, and tax evasion. He was ordered to pay $1.2 million in restitution. His Kids for Cash program has revealed that corruption is indeed within the prison system, mostly driven by the growth in private prisons seeking profit by any means necessary. That's it for me. I'm Tiny Dancer, and this has been your Higher Education for the Week. See you next time.
All right, people, here we go. Most members of the conspiracy community will be familiar with a man of such status as James Corbett, but if you aren't, let me school you a little bit. See, James has been actively pursuing the truth on his show and website, The Corbett Report, out of Japan since 2007, and as a result is now running one of the top alternative and uncompromised news sites out there that I know of. Today, James is just going to share his educated opinions on a whole host of topics because there's a lot of pieces moving on the global chessboard these days. I know I want to try to see this game a little more clearly, and I think James is just the man to help me cut through that haze. He's a pebble in the shoe of the mainstream media, a thorn in the side of the global elite, and a champion of the people in a time when the people have very little. I'm fucking honored to have him here. James, welcome to THC.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me on today.
I'm a big fan of the work you do. I know that when I want some straight talk, I can get it from you and your site. That's why I asked you to come on the show. It's definitely a lot easier to get real news in the age of the internet, but I still feel like my perception of the global stage is at least partly tainted by my place here in the American bubble, you know?
Right. No, I understand completely, and it's good to step outside of that. That's why I'm kind of, I think I'm kind of lucky to be where I am and doing what I'm doing, because I'm not only outside of my own bubble, which is Canada, which is already outside of the American bubble, but now I'm here in Japan, which is further outside the bubble. So I get to look from the outside in. So it's a different perspective, and I hope that brings something different to the table when I'm putting my podcasts and everything together.
Yeah, man, I really value that, and I hope to get out of it some days, but especially these days, it's pretty tough, you know, but I find it really interesting. You went from Canada to Japan. You know, I think most Americans would think the cliff notes to Asian countries is that generally the citizens are unemotional, overworked drones who are overly censored and have a lot of weird porn fetishes, and that Japan is like the corporate offices of the East. But I mean, tell us what it's really like. Would you consider Japan more open and free than America or Canada?
No, I don't think that's the way I'd frame it.
Okay.
It's definitely a different culture, and there are certainly aspects to it that conform to some of the stereotypes and expectations that people have out there. But then there are other ways in which it can surprise you. So, Japan is a great country, and a lot of people love to visit here. And after spending a few months here, I think most people think they have an idea of the culture. But I think after you spend several years here, you start to see sort of the undercurrent of the culture, which is a different thing entirely. But certainly on the surface, Japan is very much a reserved country. Everyone's very polite and very formal, and you don't usually get past that, certainly when you're just here for a visit. So people have that impression of the country. But there is an undercurrent. There's cultures and subcultures that occur here that you wouldn't necessarily see on the surface of society, because it is such a reserved culture. But there's a lot that's happening here. And it's an interesting place to be from that perspective, especially, during these times and all of the craziness that's happening, not only around the world, but here in Japan specifically.
Yeah, I'd assume that the people are probably a little less driven by Hollywood marketing and consumerism. I mean, is that true?
Yes and no. Certainly, it's interesting that they do have sort of their own culture industry here, if you will. Certainly, the music industry is very much J-pop oriented, obviously. So they have sort of their own little bubble here, but there is still I mean, there's still a lot of crass commercialism and a lot of pursuit of merchandise fetishism that goes on here, and people still care about Louis Vuitton handbags and things like that. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that there's a lack of that here. There's certainly a lot of it here, but it is, I mean, there's a different inflection to it, and I think that probably comes from just the history of the country, especially over the past half century, and the sort of the rise of the industrial Japan and sort of the rise of the Japanese bubble back in the 80s, and then the popping of that in the last couple of decades of stagnation has really, I think, left its mark on sort of the average Japanese population. But certainly, I think if you look in the long-term historical trends, this is a country and a culture that's just been under imperial conditioning for centuries and centuries now. And really, I mean, even in the last half century, nothing has fundamentally changed with that. All that happened really is that the old feudal lords of the past became the big mega corporations of today, and people still continue to slave away for them, and pretty unquestioningly to a large extent, although that is changing. And we have the younger generation that's growing up in a very different way than their elders did, and sort of the lifelong employment and all of that of years past is definitely gone now. So it is a culture that's undergoing huge changes right now, and not necessarily for the better, but not necessarily for the worse. I think it's still up in the air to a large extent.
Right on, man. Yeah, that's really interesting. I guess you can't really get past the corporate overlords anywhere you go. I wish I could just retreat to an area that was a little more remote, a little more tropical, but yet I still had a lightning speed internet connection. That's all I want.
Yeah, I hear you on that front. I'd just like to go somewhere a little warmer. I am Canadian, but I've become a bit of a wussy for the last 9 years, 10 years here, so.
Well, I also wanted to ask you a bit about Fukushima. I hear a lot of Armageddon-level fear porn surrounding the disaster there, as well as, the polar opposite official stories that everything's fine. But what's your assessment? You obviously must feel pretty safe if it's where you live, kind of, right?
Well, yes. I mean, qualifiedly so. I think you're exactly right that there seems to be that absolute polarization in terms of coverage. There are the people who say that there's nothing wrong and nothing could possibly be wrong with this situation. It's all sunshine and lollipops, and I'm so glad these reactors melted down. And then on the other side, there is the world is dead. Everyone is dead. Japan is a nuclear wasteland. We're all going to die. And I really want to try to break that cycle, that polarization that's taking place there, because there
Right.
is a lot of room in the middle for, I think, a bit of reality. And so I have a website for people who don't know, FukushimaUpdate.com, where on maybe not a daily basis, but several times a week anyway, it's updating with stories about the latest from Fukushima, trying to really keep an eye on what's happening there, not only specifically in terms of the Fukushima plant itself, but some of the other issues that's surrounding that. For example, the Japanese parliament just recently recently passed a bill, a state secrets bill, that's basically effectively banning any type of leaks of what is termed classified information from within the government. And a lot of people are speculating this is specifically designed to try to suppress information about Fukushima. So that is a pretty worrying thing that's happened recently. And you even had Japanese senators coming out and saying this is a return to the type of fascism of years past. So pretty worrying development on that front. And of course, on the Fukushima front, there's a lot of things going on. A couple of months ago, the big stories that were breaking were basically talking about the leaks that were happening in some of the containment vessels that they have on site for some of the basically wastewater. They're pumping water into the reactors, obviously, to keep them cool. And that wastewater is being collected and stored in these containers. They found a bunch of leaks in these containers recently that was leaking radioactive water out onto the site and eventually, of course, into the ocean. So that was a pretty big deal a month or two ago. And in the last week or two, they've started the process of transferring some of the spent fuel out of the reactor 4 spent fuel pool. So for people who don't know, this is a GE Mark I nuclear reactor. And that design, just bizarrely enough, I mean, it is a really bizarre system, but the design basically has a spent fuel pool where they take the spent fuel rods out and they put them in a pool of water to keep them cool that's situated directly above the reactor. So suspended in the air there. And of course, during the earthquake and the tsunami and everything that happened there, the reactor 4 building got severely damaged. It was listing for a time. It looked like it was maybe on the verge of collapse. They had to shore it up. And eventually they started to construct these cranes and things that they were going to use to get the spent fuel out of there so that if the building does collapse or anything happens, that it won't be an unthinkable nuclear disaster. Because the term spent fuel might make people think that, oh, this is, you know, it's not radioactive anymore. Quite the contrary, these spent fuel rods are still very much radioactive. And if they were to break or if they were to lose containment in whatever way, that would be a huge nuclear disaster. So it's a pretty precarious situation. And so they've started the process of removing those fuel rods from reactor 4 spent fuel pool. And that is a lengthy and difficult and very, very delicate process. Even under the best of times, under ideal conditions, they use computerized, basically robotic cranes that are tuned to the millimeter to do very precise moves to move these fuel rods. But obviously they can't really rely on that at this point because the fuel containment for these rods has been moved around in the earthquake and everything. So it's going to be a very difficult process. And there are something like 1,500 of these to remove. And I think they've removed the first batch, which is probably a few dozen. So it's a very time consuming, very difficult process. And I think they've only started to remove the easy ones so far. And that went okay, or so they're saying. But interestingly enough, if you look at some of the pictures and things that are coming out of there, apparently due to Japanese law, although I haven't been able to pinpoint exactly what law this might pertain to, but they have to blur out certain areas of the photos so that you can't see some of the details of the cranes and things that they have in here so that you can't presumably, I don't know, do nuclear terrorism or something of that sort. But it does certainly raise questions about, you know, what's in the blurred areas and what aren't they showing us about what's going on there.
That's funny. I actually saw a video like that, and I wondered, because Japanese also blur out their porn, and I was like, is this some type of phallus thing? Is that why you can't show it? But yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense. Man, it seems like such a out-of-control disaster. I mean, what about this thing about West Coast radiation concerns? You think that's hype, or is that legitimate?
That one's, it's difficult to say, but I just posted up a very, very thorough article from Washington's blog on Fukushima Update. It's called What is the Actual Risk for Pacific Coast Residents from Fukushima Radiation? So people who are interested, I suggest they take a look at that. It's extremely thorough and it goes through a lot of documentation, a lot of scientists and scientific opinions that basically comes to the opinion that, yes, there is going to be an increase in radioactivity in the Pacific region, in the west coast of the United States, and that is going to be harmful to human health. And it's fairly well established. I mean, it's not really a point of contention that any level of radiation is an unsafe level. I mean, it does increase the risk of cancer. So there's no such thing as a safe level of radiation. And that's something to keep in mind as basically the first wave of Fukushima remnants and the radioactivity starts to make its way to the West Coast. And it's, I mean, it's really just a question of time until it starts to be picked up. But interestingly enough, there is no U.S. agency that actually monitors radioactivity off of the coast. So there's people who are petitioning right now to try to get the government to monitor what's actually happening. But I'm not exactly holding my breath that's going to be happening anytime soon.
God, man, when you look at whether it's a plant meltdown or a weaponized atomic attack, it's like, is this technology even worth using when an area is going to be just fucked for decades because you had one mistake, you know, one weather disaster?
Right. And the answer is no. I mean, it really isn't worth using, even from an economic standpoint. The nuclear industry, the way it's been designed, doesn't even make economic sense. And nuclear reactors are not profitable, and they would not be without heavy government subsidization in a number of different ways. And this is just the stark reality of the nuclear industry as it's developed and as it's been developed since the 1950s, really, with the Atoms for Peace project and all the propaganda that people had about the nuclear industry and nuclear energy. Oh, it's going to be energy too cheap to meter, or so they said, and all of this kind of thing. It was the dawning of a new era for mankind and harnessing the power of the atom and all of that garbage propaganda that people were fed. Meanwhile, in reality, the entire nuclear industry, as it's developed, has been specifically designed around these uranium reactors that are great at producing plutonium, which can be used for the nuclear weapons industry, which is precisely why the types of designs for these types of reactors specifically have been developed and why they are so heavily subsidized by governments, because nuclear energy industry is always just an adjunct to a nuclear weapons industry. And even in a place like in Japan, where obviously they officially don't have nuclear weapons or a nuclear program, the nuclear reactors here could be, I mean, spun on a dime to produce nuclear materials for weapons. And that's, I mean, that's the real point of the nuclear energy industry as it's developed. And there are other ideas for other types of designs using other materials like liquid fluoride, thorium reactors, and other such designs that would not have the types of problems that we see with uranium reactors. But obviously the time, the money, the effort, the infrastructure has not been developed or built because it doesn't serve the nuclear weapons industry. So I think at the end of the day, this is what it's really about. It's about producing material for nuclear weapons. And that's why we have these unsafe reactors. And that's why they are all infesting all over these countries like Japan and the United States and France and others. And that's why it's going to be extremely difficult to get rid of them, if that's even a possibility. And last year, the previous Japanese government had put out a committee to study the nuclear power in industry in Japan and its future. And they actually, remarkably enough, they came back with a recommendation to actually scrap nuclear energy in Japan, to get rid of it by the middle part of this century. And guess what? The new government, as soon as they came in, the first thing they did is say, well, no, we're going to start up the reactors again, and it's going to be business as usual for the nuclear energy industry. So I'm, again, it's a huge uphill battle to even contemplate getting rid of these sores on the face of the planet.
Man, I really had no idea. It was just such a PR thing. You know, there also seems to be an element of, you know, do anything to avoid energy technologies outside of corporate control. Because there's just such a PR campaign that there are none, they're not ready yet. It's like, well, yeah, anything you're not working on is probably not ready yet.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the big factors. Certainly, if the governments that are spending so much money subsidizing nuclear energy, the way it's developed, at any rate, spent even a fraction of that on some of the other possibilities that are out there, we would see some drastic changes. And I think you're right. I mean, there's undoubtedly been a lot of suppression of various technologies that would unchain us from this ridiculous infrastructure we have that's right now chains us to these fossil fuels and nuclear energy and all of these other things, which are just outdated energies that are obviously extremely well liked by the powers that shouldn't be, because they are so easy to monopolize. And obviously, I mean, we just have to look at you know, the Rockefeller family in the United States is the sort of prime example of how the monopolization of an energy resource can lead to unthinkable wealth, which of course leads to unthinkable political power as well, as reflected in the Rockefeller Foundation and the remnants of that. So absolutely, this is, I mean, there's been all sorts of suppression of other technologies and energies, and I think we would be living on a very different planet if only we could harness some of those energies.
Totally agree, man. And, you know, on the subject of Fukushima, let's get a little crazy here. You know, and researchers in this alternative space, they can make a conspiracy out of pretty much anything. And I thought I'd ask you if you've seen any evidence at all to suggest that the tsunami or the earthquake that caused it, have you seen any evidence to support the idea that that was some type of manufactured weather attack?
There was an article that came out a couple of years ago in a scientific journal, and I can't off the top of my head remember which journal it was or the title of the article. I did have it linked up in a podcast episode that I did on Fukushima, which off the top of my head, I believe it was called What Caused the 3.11 Earthquake or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. So people can find that in my podcast archives. But that article actually talked about a ionospheric disturbance that occurred in the area of that Tohoku, that area of Japan, shortly before the earthquake began, which is interesting because there's more and more evidence now that's popping up in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. So this is not conspiracy theorizing, that there are ionospheric disturbances that are happening before earthquakes in various locales, including, of course, in this particular instance. Now, that is at the very least, it's certainly consistent with the idea that there was some sort of ionospheric heating or some sort of harp-like device may have been used on that area beforehand specifically to cause an earthquake, which is what people have been talking about for decades now with regards to HARP and HARP-like technologies, that these are capable of causing earthquakes. This is at least consistent with that. It's not conclusive, I think, but certainly worth looking into. So yes, I think there is some evidence that we could go along that route. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there who speculate on these types of things, I think, without knowing or understanding the science, and I don't pretend to be an expert on this science. I'm just a former English teacher in Japan, so you know, what do I know about the science of this? But I think there's a lot of people out there who go off half cocked with this type of thing and speculate beyond the bounds of what I think is warranted. So I think there is definitely something to pursue there, but I haven't seen anything definitive that shows, oh yes, I mean this was HARP. I don't think I've seen anything quite that definitive yet.
Man, I thought I expected you to shut that idea down. Now you got me, you're keeping me guessing here.
I do that sometimes. I keep you on your toes.
Well, another thing I'd hope we could do is kind of talk broadly about a couple different aspects of global politics and economics and kind of see what you thought. It seems like the climate is pretty tense right now, especially for people in Europe and America. We're used to living in the backyard of the all-powerful global elite. You know, we may not like the drone strikes and the slavery through debt and exploitation of poor nations, but as long as we got cable and air conditioning, we're not going to raise too much of a fuss. That's just a sad reality. But it seems now that our shadowy secret societies and closed-door think tanks are losing a bit of their power. The balance seems to be shifting a bit. I don't know if it's just stage play to usher in a new world order or if the global elite really are losing their grip, but what do you think about this, James?
That's a good question. I think it might be a little bit of both, actually. I definitely do see that there is a change in awareness that's happening across the board. And obviously, I'm biased in my opinion because I'm in the alternative media. I'm working on this day after day. I correspond every day with people who are of like mind. So obviously, I'm going to sort of be tainted in that, in my perception of what the general feeling of the public is. But having said that, I think there are absolute identifiable signs that the conversation is changing dramatically. And I've seen this just in the 6 or 7 years that I've been running my website. Back when I started, saying that 9/11 was an inside job was just about one of the most transgressive things you could think of to say and still really offend people. This day and age, it's not only become sort of more commonly accepted, but we're starting to see, even in quote-unquote mainstream headlines, we're starting to see more and more of this type of rhetoric starting to peek through. And I noticed that especially after the Boston Marathon bombing. I noticed even on Yahoo News, on The Atlantic, and other mainstream websites, they had headlines like, what is a false flag and was the Boston Marathon bombing one of them? And obviously those types of articles poo-poo the idea, but that they're even raising the idea is pretty amazing, I think, and shows that we really have busted through a lot of the rhetoric and really, I think, started to educate the public, at any rate, that these types of things exist, which is a good first step. Obviously, we have a long way to go, but it is a good first step, and we are changing the nature of the conversation. Whether this is necessarily enough, whether this is, in fact, not even something that has been, if not planned on, at least foreseen by the powers that shouldn't be, is another debate entirely. And we've seen, for example, in recent years, people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who people might know as Jimmy Carter's national security advisor and has basically been infesting the halls of power for decades now. He's been going around for the last few years talking about the global political awakening and how we've never before seen a globally politically aware and interactive, connected global situation like what we have right now, and people around the world rising up against oppression. And it's interesting to see him talking about this and everything. But of course, it means that obviously these people are not unaware of what's happening. And I can't say that I can't imagine that they haven't foreseen some of this and perhaps even planned on it. And you could even look at someone like Zbigniew Brzezinski and some of his works, like talking about the technotronic era, which he was writing about 30 plus years ago, and basically foreseeing this whole era of the internet and how that's changing basically the world and all of this, basically before even the internet existed, or at least as we know it today. So definitely some interesting things are happening, but I wouldn't exactly say that it's going to be a straightforward narrative of people wake up and the power structure ends and everyone lives happily ever after. There's obviously still a huge struggle that's shaping up, and in some ways I don't think we even have seen the beginnings of that struggle really happening yet. And it's going to be an interesting decade or two as I think the 21st century starts to take shape and we really start to understand what the narrative arc of that century is going to be. But unfortunately, I see it tending towards basically more of the same. And I think that they're trying to build up right now, for example, China to basically be the Soviet Union of the past century, and the kind of Cold War mentality that pervaded so much of the 20th century is shaping up once again with China being the big boogeyman here. And just like the Soviet Union was largely built up and fostered and funded and protected by the Western monopolist capitalists of the 20th century, so too China has been specifically built up for that purpose for the 21st century. And by many of the same people. I mean, it was Rockefeller, famously, that preceded Kissinger, that preceded Nixon to open up China and normalize relations back in the 1970s. And I think we've seen since that time just this very concerted effort to build China into what it is today. So I'm not really buying this type of Cold War rhetoric that they're starting to put out there, but it, regardless of whether or how much this is just stagecraft, at any rate, they are starting the military buildup and there are starting to be these tensions. So unfortunately, this looks like it's going to be defining a lot of the 21st century for us.
Yeah, man, that's actually a pretty great analysis. Some things I hadn't thought about. You know, we definitely are facing some uncertain times, and it seems like every week I read something about how close we are to World War III. I mean, do you think that's all just sensationalized hype? Or, I mean, do you see a few powder kegs around the planet that are primed to go off? I mean, you talked about China a bit and how we're being positioned against them. But what about what's going on in the Middle East right now?
Right. Well, there are definitely powder kegs, and whether or not they're going to go off is a different story. But that they're there and that they could go off is something that should be at least concerning for us. We should be aware of them. So, of course, what's happening in the Asia Pacific is something that I've got my eyes on here in Japan. But as you mentioned, of course, the Middle East, always a very volatile area. And we've seen some very interesting moves happening on that particular piece of the geopolitical chessboard recently. In fact, we saw, obviously, not only with this Iranian deal, which supposedly is kind of diffusing some of the tensions there and all of this, but I'm very much on board with Sibel Edmonds and others who have been talking about how this deal is really perhaps just a trapdoor, that it's just a way of setting up a series of expectations that later on they'll be able to say, look, Iran didn't live up to this expectation, therefore we've tried our best and now it's time to bomb the hell out of them. Yeah. That's always a possibility, and that's something that I'm keeping my eye on. Obviously Israel not exactly happy that that this is happening, so they'll try to undermine it in any way they can, I have no doubt. So definitely some things to keep our eye on with that. And on that particular note, we've had recently indications that Saudi Arabia has basically bought nuclear weapons from Pakistan, and Pakistan is kind of holding them ready for delivery whenever Saudi Arabia sees fit, which is an extremely interesting, extremely worrying development, because Saudis are using this as a way of saying, well, if Iran gets the bomb, we'll have it before them. But obviously that's a huge escalation in the situation in the region. And interesting also, on top of the fact that Saudi Arabia seems to be moving out from under the American military umbrella, where it has been staunchly ensconced for the last four decades, basically, since Kissinger set up the petrodollar system, whereby the Saudis would get American military protection in return for funding their oil money, sending their oil funds back through the United States and into U.S. treasuries. So basically, we've had this system for the last four decades where the entire world system has functioned on the premise that oil would be priced in U.S. dollars, and those U.S. dollars would make their way back into U.S. banks eventually. That's been the system by which the American dollar has preserved its status as world reserve currency, despite the fact that there's nothing behind it. That looks like it's breaking down. And now we've seen, for example, Saudi Arabia turning down a seat on the UN Security Council, a seat that they'd been lobbying and petitioning for quite vigorously. And then they went and turned it down once they got it, saying that it was in protest of America and the types of America things that America has been doing, for example, not going in and bombing the hell out of Syria, which is what Saudi Arabia wanted. So some interesting developments there that shows that there's some pretty drastic changes that are happening right now. And again, that plays into the whole larger picture, because we've just seen China become the world's largest oil importer, not only on the fact that obviously Chinese demand for oil is growing, but also American demand for oil imports is diminishing, because more of that demand is being fed by local supply that's being made available through the new fracking and other technologies that are increasing the oil, basically domestic oil output. So some interesting things happening there, and what this means is that the projections are by 2018, something like some ridiculous number, 70% of world oil imports are going to be going to China. So
wow.
So pretty drastic changes that are happening, and that's going to really change, I think, the situation in the Middle East. And I think Saudi Arabia might be sort of looking at which way the wind's blowing and starting to move out from under the American umbrella. And perhaps, who knows, maybe they're going to be more on board with the Chinese. And again, that just plays into the larger picture of what we're talking about.
Yeah, man, you mentioned the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. I hear so much talk about the world switching off of that. I mean, how would that really affect people who live on the U.S. dollar?
Well, this is the thing. From the U.S. perspective, for an American, the fact that it's the world reserve currency is not something that you see in your day-to-day life, but
right.
It affects everything, because not only, obviously, does it make the imports cheap, so you get cheap, you know, Chinese imports or whatever the slave labor market of the next slave labor market might be. But also it affects the American government's ability to completely fund whatever it's doing and to print off as much money as it ever wants, because people will always be there to buy American debt. And that's been the system that has propped up and made possible this unbelievable behemoth, gigantic juggernaut of American military might, which still continues to just unbelievably dwarf any other military on the planet. It's not even close. I mean, every other military combined still doesn't equal the budget of the U.S. military. So we have a situation where there's just this unbelievable superpower that dominates over the rest of the world that has been specifically funded because the American government can print off as much money as it wants, and people will continue to buy their debt, and they can fund whatever they want to do. That would come to an end if and when the dollar loses its world reserve currency status. And the Federal Reserve can pick up the slack by printing money out of thin air and buying U.S. debt. But at some point, that becomes just a ridiculous game of musical chairs.
Yes.
And that's an unsustainable system that would fall apart at some point. I mean, someone just has to draw back the curtain and see that there's no Wizard of Oz there, that it's just a little man. That's what we'd be looking at in that scenario. And it is something that a lot of people have been talking about, and a global currency reset kind of thing happening. I don't see that happening in the near immediate future. I don't think this is something we're going to be seeing, you know, next year or something. But certainly over the course of the next decade, we're going to start seeing that transition. And it's a question of what will be there to replace the dollar as the world reserve. At this particular moment, there really is nothing there that could take over from the dollar as the world reserve currency, which is why I think it's not going to happen in the immediate short term. But we're starting to see the moves toward either creating some sort of global standard based on a basket of currencies, or perhaps something new will come along, and who knows, maybe a Bitcoin or a Bitcoin type idea will take over. But again, I don't think that's going to happen in the short term.
I was actually going to say, I was going to jokingly say Bitcoin as well. I mean, it's kind of funny. You mentioned some type of world standard. This could be an opportunity for the people to actually make a decision about what the world standard will be. If people decide to conduct business with Bitcoin, I mean, you kind of can circumvent those central banks and fractional reserve banking system. It would be really interesting, but it'd also be a tall order.
Yeah, well, a very tall order, but ultimately this is where I see the solutions to these types of problems lie. They're definitely not going to solutions are not going to come from down from on high. They never have. They never will, because
right.
Obviously the status quo wants to maintain the status quo.
Yeah,
and they'll never do anything to fundamentally go against that. But I think you're right. I mean, it has to be some sort of citizen-led movement to get off of the system that we're on. And that is going to be an exceptionally difficult process, and it's going to be a long one, and it's going to be, at first, it's going to look ridiculous and puny compared to the, you know, the gigantic amount of resources that national governments can wield on these issues. But we see little glimmers of what could possibly be. And one of them that I point to several times in my podcast is Volos in Greece, which is an area where, obviously, I mean, Greece is just having ridiculous economic problems because of their position there in the Eurozone.
Yes.
And the lack of euros that are circulating around in the economy. So in Volos, they actually started their own currency system that's basically a type of let system where people donate, or they put in hours of work and they get the equivalent in this Volos currency back. And then they can facilitate exchanges with people in the market there with this currency that they've essentially created themselves. And this is the type of idea which, if I think we need to be enacting right now, not only in Volos in Greece, but everywhere around the world, we need to be building up these types of systems, local exchanges, whatever we can, as a type of alternative that will still be there whenever whatever collapse happens. These alternatives will already be there, will already be functioning, people will already be used to them, and will be able to at least survive the worst of the collapse. Without these alternative structures, we are completely at the whim of the powers that shouldn't be, and whatever they decide to do in those emergency situations, and whatever FEMA roundups might occur in the U.S. I mean, I don't tend to dwell on those types of things, but certainly the infrastructure is there for come to the camps. We'll take good care of you during this economic crisis. And I mean, I think we all know what happens from there. So I think we have to start looking at the ways that we can build up alternative currencies, complementary currencies, these types of things now while we have this opportunity before it becomes too late to do so.
Yeah, man, economic collapse is a real big concern to me right now. It's like I can see the storm coming, but I can't afford the umbrella, you know? It's like, what a poor paycheck-to-paycheck smucks like me do, you know, without much in the way of resources. I guess looking to form an alternative currency, a local-based currency system would probably be the best approach. You're right.
I hope so. I think that's the way to go. And the thing that might surprise many people is that a lot of these already exist in their community. It's just a question of looking for them. I mean, there are hundreds of these complementary currencies around the United States, and some of them are quite well established by now. In fact, one of the most famous is Ithaca, New York, where they have Ithaca Hours. And lots of local businesses, in fact, even local credit unions and some of the banks and things function with these Ithaca Hours. It's a pretty established system right now. And I think that's at least one model that people could be looking for. But again, there's lots of different models. And I'm not a particular proponent of any one model. I think that having a lot of different models is a healthy way of doing it. I'm all for competition and for having a lot of different backups, because why put all your eggs in one basket? So sure, a lot of people are into Bitcoin these days. Well, why not? Let's have some Bitcoin. Let's have some Let's Hours systems. Let's have other types of systems and let them compete with each other, which is, I think, the healthy alternative to the system we have, which is this monopoly of Federal Reserve notes or whatever it may be in whatever country people are listening in, which is, you know, from the central bank printed on high. And you just have to, you know, take what occurs with it, which, of course, is always going to be inflation caused because of the money printing that these governments do to fund the adventurous wars of aggression around the world that they wage, and all of this just horrific things that are done on the back of these dollars and yen and pesos and whatever that are printed by these central banks that people don't have any control over. Well, why would you want to sign up to a system like that when you could be exchanging with people in your own community in a completely different system? Why not put our time, effort, resources, and money into that type of system rather than feeding the beast that's currently enslaving us?
Seems so simple, man, but so many people just they don't even realize that they're enslaved themselves. It's a pretty sad predicament.
And a lot of people, I think, don't want to realize that, because
that's
it is,
true. Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of work. Let's not beat around the bush. It's not going to be an easy thing to transition off of these systems that we've been placed into. And it is a lot easier just to go along with the flow. Oh, you know, I get these dollars from my employer every month and I can spend them anywhere. Why would I bother to try to find a different way of doing this? Why would I care about supporting local community businesses when, you know, Walmart provides everything I need for so cheap? And a lot of people think that way. And I can't necessarily blame them for that. I don't like to blame the victims for their own victimization. And I think a lot of people have just been steeped into this system for so long that that they've kind of forgotten the dangers of the system that we're living in. And there are times when you see a glimmer of that. For example, the 2008 Lehman Brothers collapse was a time when I saw huge spike of people getting interested in this and looking at my website and other alternative websites. And you see that from time to time when there's a big panic, suddenly everyone will turn to the alternative media and start to realize what's going on. But it's incredible how quickly that can get shut down. And now, after a few years of this ridiculous quantitative easing that we've been under and seeing the corporate profits rising once again, that placates a lot of people. Oh, it's all okay. What, you guys are just fear mongering, blah, blah, blah. And when the next crisis occurs, they'll all be coming back again and we'll start this again. So hopefully we can at least lay the seeds right now for people who are not quite ready to flower with those seeds quite yet.
Yeah, man, no one cares until it's too late. But I know you just got back from this open source conference in France speaking on open source journalism. And I really love the idea of open source everything, you know, the idea of a resource-based economy, that kind of thing, the Venus Project thing I'm sure you're familiar with. Do you think people are starting to come around to those type of ideas more these days?
Well, as we were talking about before, I think there's a lot of flowering of awareness, at least of these types of ideas. And there is a fundamental shift that's happening in a certain percentage of the population. Again, whether it's enough, whether or what kind of effect it'll ultimately have is still up in the air. But I think it's something that we at least have some determination over, depending on what we choose to invest our time and our energies doing. And that's the beauty of the open source concept for me, which is for people who don't know, I attended this conference. It's called FOSSA 2013 in Lille, France. And it's an interesting open source conference, because open source, obviously, usually people equate that with open source software. Mm-hmm. And that really is kind of the basis of this conference. It is an open source software conference, and it's put on by a technical institute, a research institute there in France. But the FOSSA is very interesting because they're trying to expand and go out of the box in terms of what their conception of open source is. So every year they try to feature something different. This year they were looking at open source art and open source journalism. And it's just fascinating to see the ways that open source as a concept can really take root in different subjects and different fields. And this is something that I've been doing on my website since its inception several years ago, but it's not something that I've had a lot of opportunity to talk about or say why it's important. And I think it really is important to look at open source, for example, open source journalism, like what I'm attempting to do at any rate, which is in some ways it's an extremely simple concept. It's not really that revolutionary, or it shouldn't be that revolutionary for us in this age of the internet, where everyone is instantly connected to more information than has ever been available to any human being in history before. It shouldn't be that mind-blowing that someone who's telling you or trying to report the news will actually link you to the source documents that they're talking about. And yet that is a mind-blowing concept if you've only been looking at mainstream media websites. And I've only noticed in the last couple of years that mainstream sites have started putting hyperlinks in their stories to some source documents and things. I mean, it's just ridiculous to look at that. So something that was one of the, I mean, when I started the website, from the very first moment that I had the idea for the website, it was always stuck in my mind. I wanted to do a podcast, and I thought, well, obviously, this is the internet. I'm going to link to everything that I talk about. And that was always something that was important to me, because it's never been about me being this objective journalist who's going to tell you the news, because I don't think there is any such thing. Objectivity in journalism is a pipe dream. And so it's not about me being on high telling people what to think. It's me sharing basically the information that I have and the sources that I use to get that information. And people, absolutely, I encourage always people be skeptical. Don't believe what I'm saying. Please go and look at the sources and come to your own conclusions. Use your own sources. Find your own path through this information. And if you value what I'm doing, great, awesome. Then continue to listen to my podcast or look at my materials. But I never want it to be me being on high on some cloud, which is the way that obviously the mainstream media has always functioned, because it's always been about this authority and objectivity and we're telling you the news, which is just a false paradigm. And people are starting to realize there's a different way of looking at it now that we're all instantly connected through this worldwide network and we can all participate in the conversation rather than just being passive receptacles of information. And it's a really hard road to go to get people to understand that this is important and why it's important and why they shouldn't just be passive receptacles for information. And it's strange to me that even some people in my audience continue to basically kick back against that idea and, oh, I just want to be told the news. I don't want to have to look at it myself. And I understand, again, it's not easy to do this, but I think it's our responsibility if we care about the world, if we want to shape a different world for our generation and future generations. We're going to have to put in a little bit of effort. And in previous generations, that effort might have been fighting and dying in wars and of aggression and imperialism or what have you. But here we are in this little bubble of opportunity to really potentially change the world just based on what we do on a daily basis, just how we spend our time, what we choose to think about and spend our time and money and energies on. And that's to me an exciting window of opportunity at any rate. And it's a question of each of one of us out there basically doing something with this information rather than just sitting on it.
Amen, man. I agree. It really does seem like we're living in two different worlds right now. There's, you know, obviously the typical reality, but then the internet is its own world with its own systems. And I think the big struggle really is going to be corporate control coming in and dominating the internet versus the open source domination of reality. You know, either the internet culture is going to spill over into reality, or these old systems, the old corporate oligarchy, is going to dominate the internet. I think that really is the big struggle right there.
I think you're right, and I think you're right to frame it that way, because it's not about the technology itself. The technology is just a tool. It's passive. It can be used for good or bad, and it really is about the mindset, the culture, the consciousness of the people who are using this technology. And that's either going to be dominated by that corporate model where we are just passive recipients of information. We just sit there and it gets fed into us. Or we start to really actively start to participate in the creation of the world around us. And we realize that we are all creators of the world in a certain key sense. We all create our reality by acting on the world. And it's a fundamentally different mindset. Either you are just a passive sponge to sit there on a couch and soak in information, or you are someone who is actively creating a community and participating in that. And that's a very different mindset. And that I think is something that fundamentally the status quo absolutely does fear. It fears people who see themselves as history's actors rather than people who are just living in some, you know, bubble of reality that happens to them. And again, it's just about the consciousness and about the way that people perceive themselves in the world. And that's ultimately what I'm attempting to do, is to try to hopefully facilitate that change in awareness, the revolution of the mind that I think is the fundamentally important revolution, because I don't think taking pitchforks to Washington is going to change anything. I think it's going to have to happen when people start to fundamentally change the way they live their lives on a day-to-day yep. basis and the way they interact with people around them. That's where reality is, and that's where we have to start and end, and hopefully ultimately we will get there, but it's not going to be an easy road.
Yeah, man, well said. Well, hey, James, I know you got to get out of here. It's been a real pleasure having you on, man. Can you tell the people where they can keep up with your work, what you got going on, before I let you go?
Sure. Well, I do a lot of different things. I write an editorial for the International Forecaster. I do video reports for GRTV, the branch of globalresearch.ca. I do a weekly video report for boilingfrogspost.com. And we're starting a new series with Boiling Frogs Post. Myself, Sibel Edmonds, Peter B. Collins, and surprise guests will be on for a roundtable discussion. It will be a weekly series once it really gets going. Right now, it's just going to be every couple weeks or so as we're starting to get that series going. So a lot of different things. And then, of course, I have my own podcast and interviews and articles and videos that come out on a regular basis. The best way to follow my work is just go to CorbettReport.com, CorbettReport.com, and it's all linked up there. You'll find all of the different things that I'm doing. So hopefully that's the one-stop shop. And as I say, I have other websites like FukushimaUpdate.com and things, but that's all linked up from the site as well.
Excellent. Well, thanks, James. Very enlightening chat. That about does it for me. Keep fighting the good fight, my man.
I appreciate it. Anytime you need me, just let me know.
Alrighty, have a good one.
Take care.
There you have it, Higher Side Chatters. Thanks again. Please share the show. You can stay in touch with me on Twitter and Facebook. Please review the show where you can. The Stitcher Awards are coming up. I want to maybe try to get in on that. And you can still get in on the first THC Money Bomb yourself, where I've thought out what to me is a win-win situation for everyone involved. Check out conspiracies.net and let's make this alternative culture the mainstream culture. Thanks for sticking with me, people. Love ya. Your move, Kemosabe. There's a war coming down between my breasts and mine. Stop that!
Bernadine.